We will have testing facilities that are testing, and we will have a lot of cultivation facilities growing a lot of legal marijuana in Alaska.
State regulators say the marijuana business structure is moving forward, but some advocates say not fast enough. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, music is helping mothers who are in prison reconnect with their children.
God gave me my kids as precious angels, so I know I'm going to get my angels back. I just got to do me right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to alaskacleanharbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska's top marijuana regulator says pot will be available for purchase by February. But industry advocates expressed frustration today that it's taken nearly 2 years since voters approved the sales. And legislators say they'd like to see the state allow marijuana consumption in private clubs. Some lawmakers would also like state officials to work to improve marijuana businesses' access to banks. Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office Director Cynthia Franklin told state legislators that marijuana testing should begin within weeks.
I believe that by the time we arrive at February of 2017, we will have stores that are operating. We will have product manufacturers that are making products, which have been individually approved by this board, which is a tremendous amount of work. We will have testing facilities that are testing, and we will have a lot of cultivation facilities growing a lot of legal marijuana in Alaska.
She spoke at a joint meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees at the Legislative Information Office in Anchorage. Lawyer Jana Weltzen says her marijuana business clients are paying to rent property, but they're not receiving revenue.
It has been 2 years, and I'm getting to the point where some of my clients have been paying rent, you know, for a really long time.
Franklin says her office has been affected by having too few staff members for the amount of work it's required to do. Another obstacle for marijuana businesses is banking. Division of Banking and Securities Chief Examiner Patrice Walsh says Congress must change the law before banks will accept marijuana business customers.
Right now, the Division of Banking and Securities is not aware of any bank or credit union in our state that is willing to bank marijuana businesses at this time because the businesses are illegal under federal law.
But Anchorage Republican Senator Liesl McGuire says she'd like to see the state work with federal regulators to make it easier for banking for marijuana businesses to advance. She notes a memo from former Deputy U.S. Attorney General James Cole, who said the federal government would take a hands-off approach to marijuana in states that legalized it.
States who have legalized this have an obligation to set up regulations that provide security and authority and a clear path for banks, lending institutions in that state to secure a legal pathway for lending.
Lawmakers also questioned Attorney General Jana Lindemuth on her recent opinion that marijuana consumption is illegal in private clubs. They disagreed with her opinion that these clubs are public spaces. The ballot question that legalized marijuana said it would be illegal to consume in public. Legislators raised the possibility that state law could be changed to allow marijuana in clubs. The U.S. Senate is likely to pass a water resources bill this week that would send $100 million to Flint, Michigan to resolve that community's drinking water crisis. But the bill could be a plum for rural Alaska, too. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan says the bill includes a new grant program he championed to help small and disadvantaged communities build water projects. Towns without household drinking water or wastewater services would be at the head of the line. Sullivan says those communities are primarily in Alaska.
There are other communities throughout the country that have this problem, but I think a lot of it is centered in Alaska. So this is going to be a, right now, 5-year program, $1.4 billion. So significant sums of money authorized.
The pending bill would establish the program with $20 million, but the big money would have to come from annual appropriation bills. Those are the spending bills that are often bundled into giant omnibus packages. They are fiercely contested in Congress. Still, Sullivan says he thinks it's possible Congress will appropriate the money for the water grant program, starting with the $230 million the bill authorizes for 2017.
I think there's a good chance because, A, this is infrastructure, and there has been bipartisan consensus in the Congress on the importance of infrastructure.
The bill also says that if Flint can't spend all its water money in 18 months, the balance would be reallocated to the new grant program. The Alaska Department of Natural Resources announced it's hired a new deputy commissioner in charge of oil and gas. Mark Wiggin left Brooks Range Petroleum to take the post where he worked as an engineering and development manager. The deputy commissioner role has been vacant since March when Marty Rutherford temporarily stepped into the lead role at the Department of Natural Resources before she became a trustee of the Permanent Fund Corporation Board. Wiggin will work under Commissioner Andy Mack, who took the reins of the department in July. In a press release announcing the hire, Mack touted Wiggin's 3 decades of experience in Alaska's oil fields, including big developments like Lisburn, Alpine, and Mustang. Before working at Brooks Range Petroleum, Wiggin was at ASRC Energy Services, focusing on the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project. In Unalaska, police are investigating after a man's body was found in a creek on Monday. The Unalaska Department of Public Safety has identified the man as 46-year-old Greg Kortsema, who had significant head injuries and was found by a pair of local hikers. Police say Kortsema worked sporadically in Unalaska over the last 20 years, most recently on a fishing vessel, Alaska Trojan. They know Kortsema visited a local bar on September 2nd, but they're still trying to determine his activities between then and when his body was found near Captain's Bay. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a big increase in tourism for Homer.
More and more motorcyclists are coming in. The other trend I'm seeing is more and more people, depending on what their budget is, are coming to camp.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
A program aimed at helping mothers who are in prison connect with their kids is called the Lullaby Project. Professional musicians work with inmates at the Highland Mountain Correctional Center in Eagle River to write songs for the inmates' children. Then the musicians record them onto a CD. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman was there as they listened to the recordings.
2 months ago, Sean Muese, an inmate at Highland, sat down with musician Hillary Morgan. Muese carried a booklet she had filled with details about her 7 kids and a letter addressed to them. She was ready to write them a lullaby, or so she thought.
She actually came and she had already written something, and she said, "This is the song. This is what I've written for the song." And I looked at the words, and I knew that wasn't the song, because it didn't have her heart in it.
Morgan says she tried to tease more out of Muese. Together, they looked at photos of her kids and thought about the words they wanted to use. Muese was impressed by Morgan's ability to connect to her feelings.
It was crazy because she could tell like things that I didn't like, but just the way I expressed like my face expression, she's like, "Oh, you don't like it. All right, next." And
during the 5-hour-long session, they wrote about the first moments Muese spent with her children and how sorry she was to be away from them. The goal of the Lullaby Project is to help mothers who are struggling to connect with their kids. It was developed by the Carnegie Foundation about 8 years ago. Musicians have worked with teen mothers and women in homeless shelters and prisons. This is the first time it's been done in Alaska. The project has 3 short phases, writing the songs, recording in a professional studio, then coming together to share. While writing, Morgan and Muese were having trouble thinking of the music behind the words. So Morgan asked Moise to sing the lullabies of her childhood.
So she sings me this song, and it's in Samoan, and I'm like, well, that doesn't help. So, so I said, that's great. Did they sing any other songs? And she sings another song in Samoan, and I'm like, the light bulb went on, and I said, do your kids speak Samoan at home? And she goes, yeah, they do. And I was like, do you want to write this in Samoan? And she goes, can we do that?
After their writing session, Morgan joined with a local Samoan choir to record the piece. When Moise sat with the other project participants to listen to the song for the first time, she erupted in sobs. After it ended, she tossed her arms around Morgan.
You sound so awesome! I would never think you're white.
Moise says she knows the song won't make up for the past, but she hopes it helps rebuild her relationship with her children.
What I'm hoping to get out of this is restoration, and, you know, I want to be able to see my kids. It's going on 3 years I haven't seen my kids.
She says the song and the words in Samoan also give her pride in her culture.
The language is so beautiful, you know, and just one line, it has a lot of meaning. And that's why I love my culture. I love my language, because you can just say one word in my language and it means a lot of things. And just hearing that, that's just, I don't know, I came in here all, you know, sad, but when I heard that, it's like angels from heaven, you know, like.
The words in the chorus mean angels from above. Precious to my heart.
And that's what I believe in. My kids are the angels from above. God gave me my kids as precious angels. So I know I'm going to get my angels back. I just got to do me right now.
All of the lullabies will be performed by the musicians and some of the inmates during a public concert at Highland Mountain on September 24th and will be available on CD. The funds go straight back into the project through the nonprofit Keys for Life, so another group of women can also write their children a lullaby. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Homer, the little town at the end of the road, is becoming an increasingly popular travel destination. Jan Knudsen is the Visitor Center Coordinator with the Homer Chamber of Commerce. She says 2016 has been a record-breaking year for the Homer tourism industry.
It has been a banner year for Homer and the surrounding area in terms of the number of visitors. We had over 12,600 people come in to the Chamber Visitor Center.
Increases in the number of visitors has translated into higher revenues for a number of Homer businesses. Homer City Campgrounds, for instance, reported a revenue increase of $5,000 in comparison to August 2015. Besides the increase in the number of visitors, Knudsen says, the Chamber of Commerce has seen a number of other changes.
The trends that we see that are new this year, one is more and more motorcyclists are coming in. The other trend I'm seeing is more and more people, depending on what their budget is, are coming to camp because their budget may be limited, but they really want to come to Homer.
Knudsen says local B&Bs have also seen increases in occupancy. In less than a month, Skagway voters will cast ballots for two open borough assembly seats. But one more seat may be vacant soon. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
Earlier this year, longtime assemblyman and restaurant owner Dan Henry was sentenced to a year and a day in prison for failing to file his income taxes. He must report to a federal prison facility by November 1st. Since the federal tax case conviction and sentencing, Henry has continued to serve on the assembly without publicly addressing the situation. But some residents have spoken out at recent meetings. At a meeting in August, Bob Carlson referred to a letter Henry penned in the Skagway News. Henry talked about his volunteer service to Skagway and how he helped improve the town's finances as an assembly member.
I want to say I don't want to conflate volunteerism that you've done that's quite honorable with permission to do whatever you want as my on my behalf as a representative. I believe the assembly members should be of the highest character and moral. I feel that you failed me, and our community too.
Carlson was one of a few residents who called on Henry to resign his seat in time for it to be placed on the October election ballot. But Henry has not resigned, and it is now too late to change the ballot. It is unclear how long Henry plans to continue serving on the assembly. In his Skagway newsletter, he says he plans on, quote, serving my town until such a time that I can't. Henry has not returned KHNS's multiple calls for comment. Skagway Borough Code says an assembly seat will be declared vacant if a member is physically absent from the municipality for 90 consecutive days. But other assembly members have the power to excuse that member if they choose. Now that it's certain Henry's seat won't be included on the ballot, if he does resign, the remaining members will appoint someone to his spot. Resident Steve Heitz spoke at the most recent assembly meeting, asking that whichever candidate isn't elected in October be appointed to Henry's seat.
I would humbly suggest to the mayor and to the assembly members who are listening that when Dan Henry's seat at this table is vacated, the mayor would choose to appoint the third candidate, whoever that individual might be, for their running for the office and putting themselves up for a vote of the citizens of Skagway.
The three assembly candidates are incumbent Tim Cochran, David Brenna, and Orion Hansen. Skagway faced a similar situation 3 years ago. In 2013, then-Assemblyman Mark Schaefer was elected mayor, leaving his assembly seat vacant. Meeting minutes indicate that some assembly members favored appointing Christopher Takaro, who had just lost his election bid. But Schaefer nominated a different person, Jim Sager, for the spot. The assembly followed the mayor's recommendation. If someone is appointed to Henry's seat, they'll serve on the assembly until the next municipal election, instead of the usual 3-year term. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to slow down and take care with any cleaning, fueling, or painting products while maintaining your boat this summer. Be smart to save money and protect our marine environment and our beautiful ocean and coastline. Let's keep the water clean and keep our fish healthy. For more information, go to AlaskaCleanHarbors.org. This message is sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Despite public outcry from Ketchikan and Petersburg residents over recently announced plans to log Alaska mental health-owned land within those communities, the state agency hasn't backed down on its decision. So if federal land exchange legislation doesn't pass Congress this session, the process to open Ketchikan's Deer Mountain and land above homes on Petersburg-Mitkoff Highway will begin. But as KRBD's Layla Carey reports, there are some options that the trust might consider.
John Morrison, executive director of Alaska Mental Health Trust Land Office, says
the best way to save Deer Mountain, as they say, is to do whatever they can to affect the legislation that will direct the land exchange.
Save Deer Mountain is the name of a Ketchikan group that formed a day after the trust board's decision. Organizer Bob Weinstein says the group's Facebook page quickly attracted more than 1,000 followers and has been a primary source of sharing information and concerns. One big concern has been the January 15th deadline. Weinstein argues that doesn't give Congress enough time to act, especially in an election year. But Morrison says the January 15th deadline was carefully chosen. He says the trust needs to start its timber sale process by then because otherwise the timber industry might be gone.
The timber industry in Southeast Alaska has openly said in, you know, the Alaska Forestry Association meetings that they effectively have enough timber to last and make their business operations viable through mid-2017.
Which, Morrison says, means the trust needs to take advantage of the timberland it has while it still can. So, sometime before January 15th, they'll know whether the land exchange is going to happen. If it isn't going to happen, Morrison says the Trust Land Office will draft a best interest opinion to log the land and will publish that for 30 days. After that, he says, there's a 20-day period to consider public input and then another 20 days to reconsider the decision to log. Then,
based on weather conditions and things of that nature, we would potentially let a contract this coming spring, and then it would be up to the operator as to the timing of when they harvested the timber.
But what about some options people in the affected communities have suggested, like purchasing the land to keep the trees in place? Morrison says until it's clear the land exchange won't happen this session of Congress, the trust won't pull any parcels from that exchange package. And the exchange is the trust's preferred resolution. But if and when it's clear that the exchange is off the table,
we would gladly accept applications to purchase this property, purchase the carbon credits on the property. I could think of any number of things we might consider. However, they would have to be in the best interest of the trust.
Since the trust's announcement, local governments in Ketchikan and Petersburg have gone on record opposing the proposed harvest and supporting the land exchange, as have other officials and individual residents. Weinstein says he too supports the land exchange, but he has issues with how the trust board made its decision. He questions the legality of the vote itself and says there was a lack of proper notice and procedure. Weinstein also questions the feasibility of logging Deer Mountain.
They haven't yet talked about really, given the slopes in Deer Mountain, the viability of truly doing a substantial harvest, B, if they will put up a bond to deal with landslides that are likely to occur.
Similar concerns about landslides have been expressed regarding the Petersburg parcel. Weinstein also disputes the argument that logging must happen now, before the timber industry completely dies. He says the state could help.
Can they move up, for example, some potential sales in the state forest to help bridge the time needed to make a reasonable effort to see the legislation pass?
Weinstein says he hopes the governor's office will step in to help come up with a reasonable path forward. He adds that the idea of communities purchasing the parcels is something to consider, and he wasn't aware until recently that the trust would even consider that option. He says that's an example of the lack of communication from the state agency.
For me, that's all the more reason why I think it would be helpful for them to have a proactive, positive dialogue with the community, get us behind the exchange legislation instead of taking the approach they did that I think is rather boneheaded and counterproductive to what they're trying to do.
While the trust board won't consider options like a land sale until after it's clear that the exchange won't happen, Morrison says proposals can be submitted anytime. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The United States is in the midst of negotiations with Canada over an agreement on Canadian lumber imports. Many U.S. sawmill owners argue that the Canadian mills receive government subsidies on government-owned lands, making it difficult for the U.S. market to compete. The 2006 softwood lumber trade agreement expired last year, and a one-year freeze on tariffs ends in October. KSTK's Aaron Bolton explains how that uncertainty is affecting Southeast timber.
The U.S. and Canadian governments have been at odds for decades on whether Canadian sawmills receive government subsidies, particularly stumpage fees, a tax on harvested trees. Mills in the states say that gives Canadian producers an unfair advantage in the U.S. market. The deal that was struck in 2006 was renewed in 2012. It was designed to keep Canadian timber within a certain price range. If it fell below that range, tariffs would be enacted. The deal expired last October, kicking in a one-year standstill period, including a freeze on U.S. tariffs. What this means for the timber industry in Southeast depends on the lens you're looking through. Alcan Forest Products is based in Ketchikan, but operates in Canada as well. Alcan partner Brian Brown says the uncertainty of a new trade agreement is making Canadian sawmills unable to commit to prices on Alaska logs.
We sell primarily in Canada, it'd be red cedar logs. We just did a shipment in there
Right now, you know, nobody's been able to commit to a second one because of his duties.
Brown says Alcan does 3 to 4 shipments into Canada a year. He says each shipment is about 600,000 tons and is valued around $1 million. If a deal is not struck in October, the U.S. is likely to put tariffs on Canadian timber. Brown says he doesn't buy into the argument that Canadian companies are subsidized and says he would prefer a free market and no tariffs.
For the sake of argument, I'll say that that's true, that the Canadian sawmills are being subsidized by their government. Who gets the benefit of that, ultimately? It's the U.S. consumer.
Others in Alaska disagree. Owen Graham of the Alaska Forest Association says he would like to see the 2006 deal renewed. He said it's needed not just because Canadian producers low operating costs, but also because the Canadian dollar is weaker.
Probably 70% of our lumber goes to the lower 48, so to speak. And of that, you know, I'd say 30% of our production is hemlock that is just getting killed by the Canadian, dumping low-cost lumber on the market. But it's primarily because of the exchange rate.
Graham says those numbers are based on Southeast's largest mill, Viking Lumber. Alaska State Forester Chris Mache says he agrees that a renewal would be best. He says most timber across Alaska is predominantly exported to foreign markets, mostly Asia. According to a Bloomberg report, Canada's Trade Minister Chrystiette Freeland and U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman spoke last week at the G20 summit in China, but a deal could not be reached. Freeland was quoted as saying, "There is no guarantee we are going to get a deal that works for both sides." The deadline is October 12th. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Shayla Farzan in Homer, Emily Files in Haines, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Aaron Bolton in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program. The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.